Good morning. So this morning I'm going to talk about the next four lines in Trusting Heart Mind. I talked about the last four lines in my last talk. I would read it off a program, but actually I don't see a program. Yeah, there's a program. Okay. The changes that occur in this empty world we call real only because of our ignorance. Do not search for the truth, only cease to cherish opinions. Do not remain in the dualistic state, avoid such pursuits carefully. If there is even a trace of this and that, right and wrong, the mind essence will be lost in confusion. Okay, so line by line. The changes that occur in the empty world we call real because of our ignorance. So, on Friday night, I was talking about not being here for this retreat. Those of you who don't know about Zen Center, this is our 7-day Rahatsu retreat that we do every year, and that I am always here for. I am always here for. So it feels a little bit weird, a little bit discombobulating to be at home resting. It feels like maybe I'm not good enough. I should be better to be home resting. Well, where did that silly thought come from? Where do these silly thoughts come from? And as I was saying on Friday, on the other hand, I'm here. Where is there for us to go? I'm here. I've always been here. I'll always be here. Where else can I be? There's a deep joy in that presence, in the absence, which is that presence. A deep joy. I don't know where it comes from. I don't know whose it is. I don't think it belongs to anybody, does it? In that complete absence, which is the presence, which is not some silly Zen thing. You can make it into a silly Zen thing if you want. So, Sharada Devi married Ramakrishna. Sharada Devi married Ramakrishna, and she was betrothed when she was 5. Now, you guys may think, oh, that's a typical Indian way of doing things. 5 is just the right age. Sorry. That's their culture. But although they were betrothed, she didn't actually have any contact with them until she was 18. They had the wedding when she was 5. And then when she was 18. Because they weren't stupid. They knew about men and women, right? So when she was 18, she went to live with them. And Ramakrishna's parents were worried about him. Because they thought he was some kind of a meditation zealot. They thought, some of the people in the neighborhood thought, that Ramakrishna was out of his mind. That's what the story was, that Ramakrishna had gone out of his mind. So they said, well, let's find a girl from a good family who would really seem stable. And so they went to the family nearby. Sharada Devi is only 5, but look at her. She already cleans the linen. Sews, all these things that a good Indian woman does at 5. She will settle Ramakrishna down. Right? So, and Sharada Devi heard lots of stories when she was young, between 5 and 18, about Ramakrishna being kind of weird. Kind of weird. All the time going off and doing retreats, not hanging out a lot with people, going into trances, having all kinds of visions, all kinds of laughter coming up all the time that didn't seem to be precipitated by anything. No joke. People didn't see the joke. This guy's just laughing. So then she went to live with him when she was 18, and he was 36. Typical Indian, 36. And so she discovered that Ramakrishna was not out of his mind in the way that people thought. Not crazy. Not crazy. As a matter of fact, he taught her the practice at 18, meditation practice of just being present with each activity. They got up at 3 a.m. She got up at 3 a.m. and he got up at 3 a.m. And they did all the work around the house, all the karma yoga, and then they spent a little bit of time doing meditation, but it was mostly bhakti yoga. It was mostly devotional. One-pointedness through giving yourself to the deity of your choice. Because Ramakrishna was very eclectic. He said, Buddha, Jesus, Kali, all the same. All the same. But Kali was his special love. You know Kali? How many of you know Kali? Yeah. Darkness. Total darkness. The dark goddess of the universe. If you vanish into Kali, see what happens. Something wonderful might happen. If you completely vanish into her, something wonderful. So they practiced. They practiced. But they didn't practice to get somewhere. They practiced to give themselves, to be present in this world, to participate. A lot of singing, a lot of prayer, not too much meditation. But the singing and the prayer was all meditative. It was all focusing on really cultivating deep stillness, discovering deep stillness. So this Rahatsu retreat, Sesshin, is our, what would you say, our high church Sesshin. Because almost all of our other meditation now are Tim style. With just sitting, not much ritual, not much bowing, not much bhakti, almost no bhakti. But Rahatsu, traditionally, even though supposedly Japanese Zen is Jiriki, self-power, Japanese Zen is full of Tariki, other power, full of Tariki. And that's what we're doing. Look at all the bowing you've done already today, those of you who are here. Look at all the chanting you've done. Look at all the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas that you've given yourself to, whom you don't even know, maybe could care less about. But you've given yourself to them, so they'll support you. You give yourself, and you get back. Your cup runneth over if you give yourself. It's amazing. It's amazing. But it's simple. It's really simple. So Ramakrishna died, right? Yeah. And just before he was dying, Sharada Devi was crying. I talked about this some other time, maybe last time I talked. Sharada Devi was crying. And Ramakrishna said, Sharada, I'm not leaving. The clothing is leaving. The voice is leaving. The eyes, the O's, the nose and the mouth are leaving. I'm not leaving. Where is there for me to go? Sharada, where is there for me to go? So then he died, right? And then it was time for Sharada to be a widow and change her attire and wear black and not talk to people. But she didn't do it. People said, Sharada, you're supposed to do all this stuff as a widow. She said, I'm not a widow. I'm not a widow. He's not dead. The true I, the changes that occur in the empty world we call real only because of our ignorance. Only because of our ignorance. Only I. alone and sacred. Only you, Monica, alone and sacred. As you are, alone and sacred, with everything. With everything. Only you. Only you. So we say, Bodhidharma said, a special transmission outside the sutras, no dependence on words and letters, direct pointing to the heart mind, attaining enlightenment and becoming Buddha. So we could say, what's the deal between about Ramakrishna and Sharada Devi? In the books it says Sharada Devi was his first disciple. And really his chief disciple, the one who got his way the most. And yet she never even became a nun or a monk. And of course, as a woman, she was a little bit second class. But she didn't know. And everybody wanted to spend time with Sharada Devi for the rest of their lives. They didn't know why. They didn't know why. But in a way, they did know why. In a way, there was something here. Transmission? No transmission? I don't know. I don't know. Awakening to the deathless, you guys. That's what this is about. Awakening to the deathless. The stillness, which is birthless and deathless. You can do it. You can do it. Trusting in the heart and mind. Trusting in the heart and mind until the in evaporates completely. And as I said in the talk I gave recently, we need to set the compass of our hearts. Jack Kornfield's expression. We need to set the compass of our heart to realizing Buddha nature, to realizing deathlessness. And in a retreat, often you have to continually to reset it because you get bored or tired or pissed. Maybe not even in a retreat. Maybe just sitting here for 40 minutes. Maybe just sitting for 20 minutes. Set and reset. Most important step on the Eightfold Path. Intention. Second step. Aspiration. Aspiration. Intention. Come back to the aspiration. Come back to the intention. And when you lose the intention, when you lose the aspiration, go back to the first step, which is your understanding. Your understanding that the changes that occur in this empty world we call real because of our ignorance. We can imbibe that. We can imbibe that ourselves, each of us. And of course, what it really does mean is going out of our minds. It really means going out of our minds. You can't do it within your mind. I'm not talking about psychosis. I'm not talking about delusions. I'm not talking about even hallucinations. I'm talking about going out of your mind. Delusional. Psychotic. That's really in your mind. Big time. That's really get stuck in your mind. Going out of it. Because within your mind, you're just doing more of the same. You're just caught by more ideas, more thoughts, more attempts to be a good boy or a good girl, or really, really do this meditation the right way. So we do these practices, and as I talk about them, I've been talking the last year or so about meditation practice, our zazen, as being made up of just classical meditation in Buddhism, which is shamatha and vipassana. That's all it is. Shamatha and vipassana. Not vipassana in the modern way vipassana is used, just classically. That's what it is. Shamatha and vipassana. Shamatha, to calm down. To do calming practice. And vipassana, to see into. To see into. So the shamatha practice that I was taught when I first came to Zen Center, when I was barely out of diapers, still in diapers in many ways, was watching the breathing and counting the breathing. That's what Suzuki taught me. That's a shamatha practice. That's a calming practice. And there are lots and lots of them. And everybody says, this is the Zen way. Oh, give me a break, you guys. Give me a break. Find a shamatha practice that works for you and do it. And do it. If breathing, being with your breathing, saying something when you breathe, saying a nice little Thich Nhat Hanh expression if it helps you, doing a loving kindness meditation, maybe you need to do a loving kindness meditation. Doing a Tung Lin meditation. Repeating. Gyate, gyate. After all, this is Rahatsu. You're saying gyate, gyate twice a day. You're completely giving yourself to Prajnaparamita already, aren't you? The mother of Buddha, aren't you? Ma, ma, ma. Right? Prajnaparamita, the mother of Buddha. And this is what Ramakrishna taught Sharada Devi to repeat. Ma, 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 from the bottom of her heart. Same. Ma, mu. Chinese mu. Sanskrit ma. Ma, mother. I mean, you can go on and on, right? Doesn't matter. Find something. Find a shamatha practice that resonates and do it. Give yourself to it completely. And don't evaluate too much. If you evaluate too much, you'll be never doing one. You'll just be always comparing it to the other one. Or do that. And as I've said, maybe I said this last time, I don't know. That's the boat that you need to go into the Buddha Nature Sea. The Buddha Nature Sea is kind of rough. Kind of rough. There's a lot of turbulence. In Sesshin or in daily life, there's a lot of worries and concerns. If you just do Shikantaza, if you just do Vipassana, Shikantaza are the same way I'm using it. If you just do them, just bear attention, bear awareness, without any boat, your mind would just sometimes go crazy. So you need a boat. You need a boat. But then, when your mind is calmed down some, then you can move on to Vipassana. Then you can move on to Shikantaza. Then you get out of the boat into the sea itself. You get out, no wetsuit, completely naked, bare awareness, bare attention, Shikantaza. Woof! Wonderful, but not easy. And if you get all frazzled and mixed up and thinking about the next meal and how that compared with the last meal and when it's time to serve and da-da-da, who burned the rice? These are the people who are in retreat I'm talking to, not the rest of you guys. You don't think about stuff like that, right? You just cruise along. Then get back in the boat for a while. Get back in the boat for a while. Then, when the sea is calmed down enough, the boat is calmed down enough for you to get back in the sea, get back in the sea. And if you do this practice, at some point you will become very salty. You will become very salty. Your pores will be nothing but salt. Your hair will be nothing but salt. Your nose will be nothing but salt. Is that transmission? Woo! Maybe that's transmission. Woo! I might give it to you. I'll give you some salt. A special transmission. Outside the scriptures. Sharada Devi couldn't read. Now, Hui Neng supposedly couldn't read too, but we understand that was fabricated. Because Zen wanted to be, you know, Zen. Everybody wants to be up, right? Special transmission. It's not a special transmission. It's always going on. It's always going on. How can it be special? But it is outside the scriptures. It's outside all this stuff that you study and memorize and Yogacara eyes and Hua Yen eyes, all that stuff. That stuff is just to help you. And there's no dependence on words and letters. No dependence. Words and letters, you're not even in the boat yet. You're just on the shore. Well, you need to go back to the shore sometimes and, you know, hang out. That's fine. Hang out with your friends, but that's not real practice. Not real practice. okay, the changes that occur in this empty world we call real only because of our ignorance. Do not search for the truth, only cease to cherish opinions. This is the first one I read. This is the first one I remember reading years and years ago. Maybe I read the whole thing years and years ago. But this one I've carried around in my head for years. Only cease to cherish opinions. Only cease to cherish opinions. Not so easy. Not so easy. Not so easy. I've been practicing for 40-some years. Do I cherish opinions less than I did 40-some years ago? Well, maybe a little. Maybe a little. I don't know. How much? I don't know. It's difficult. It's a difficult practice, right? Because the ego, Tim, identifies with opinions. That's who I am. I have an opinion. And most of my opinions come from childhood. Most of the opinions that are deep-seated come from childhood and adolescence. Deep-seated. I don't think that Freud was right about much, but he was right about this, that mother and father really, really form ego. Experience with mother and father really form ego. And that's why it's so hard to let go of opinions, because they were formed at an age we were so malleable and so receptive, and we firmed it up. We firmed it up. And so I don't care whether you're 50 or 60 or 70 or 80. That childhood stuff is still in you. And if you think it isn't and you're some great enlightened being, I don't even want to hang out with you, frankly, because there's something fake going on. There is something fake going on. It's just the way the world is. It's not bad. It's cool. It's seaweed in this, seaweed in the ocean. Too much seaweed in the ocean. Get back in the boat. Do your shamatha. But when the ocean is really still, you can get there and just be with the seaweed. Not fighting with it. Just smelling it. Just enjoying its unusual contours. Not exactly even enjoying it, just seeing it. So someone came in to me during my one-to-ones with folks, with my Doksan a while ago, and said to me something like, this is a person who is really into practice, who's really serious about practice, said, how do I go about modifying my hating and loving? My pushing and pulling. How do you go about it? Well, Sung San's attitude in this is, let go of your opinion that you have to do anything about it at all. Let go of the opinion you have to do anything about it. As a friend of mine said to me years ago, it's like cleaning a wall with turds. It's like cleaning a wall with turds. Go ahead, do something about it. See what happens. See what happens. Clean wall. We clean walls with turds all the time, don't we? Don't we? That's why we have to sit. That's why we have to do rahatsu. So we can just see ourselves doing this. Just see how absurd this is, and yet not get. Just see it and laugh. Just see it and cry. Right? But we can, and this is again classical Buddhist thought that I talk about a lot, we can exercise our legs. In this session, we're exercising our legs. Our leg of behavior. Speech, action, well, livelihood. But those of you in retreat, I guess your livelihood is just being alive here. Speech, action, and livelihood. That's the behavioral component of the path. And then the meditative component. Effort, mindfulness, concentration. Meditation, and behavior. That's what you're doing in retreat. And there's a lot of behavior in this retreat, because this is a traditional bhakti style, ritualized Japanese form retreat. So there's a lot of behavior. There's a lot of specificity, a lot of meticulousness, which I hated for years. I don't hate it anymore. I know what happened. But I hate it. No, I love it. I hated it for years. And if there had been other Buddhist teachers, I would have left. But there was only this one guy, and he was cool. But there weren't any others in San Francisco when I was young. Except a Chinese guy who burned incense on his body. And that was his practice. Tolong. Shh. I thought, well, no, I'll do the Japanese ritual. Thank you. Japanese ritual is fine. I don't need that. Master Tolong. My friends served Master Tolong. My Chinese friends, Shirley and Betty. They served him, and then I went to go to meet him too. And he wouldn't eat onions, because he said onions would, the passions would come up. So, no onions. And there were many other things about him, and he showed us the scars. It was when he showed us the scars that I said, I'm out of here, man. I don't need that practice. I'll let Monica do that practice. So we're doing both. We're doing the behavior. And of course we're not talking, but we're speaking with our bodies. We're speaking when we enter the room. We're speaking when we gusho. We're speaking when we tie up our eating bowls. We're speaking. We're always speaking. Do not search for the truth, only cease to cherish opinions. Do not remain in a dualistic state. Avoid such pursuits carefully. Avoid such pursuits carefully. So, even though you might be trying to follow my directions, follow my instructions about shamatha and vipassana or not, doing your own instructions, that's fine. Still, that can get kind of dualistic, because then you're trying to get it right. You're trying to do this practice right. And you're comparing it to someone else who seems to have been sitting much less time than you and looks like they're much more focused. Maybe you have been wasting your life doing Zen. Maybe you should be doing something else before it's too late. And you probably have to hang out during the rest of this retreat, because it would be, you don't want people to think poorly of you. But after this, never come back here again. Never come back here again. That's what people think all the time. All the time. Because they don't like what Katagiri Roshi used to say. They don't like putting the snake in a bamboo pole. It doesn't feel good to them. It doesn't feel good. So, if you're not doing this practice well, don't forget that you're made up in the first place. You're made up. Okay, you're not doing it well. The made-up I is not doing the made-up well. You're made up. Go out of your mind. This is about going out of your mind. Within your mind, it's just all trying to get somewhere, trying to be someone, trying to keep up, trying to get calm or enlightened or at least get through the next sitting. But this is about going out of your mind, this practice. When the searching stops, you're the enlightenment you've been seeking. You're the enlightenment you've been seeking. You are it. You are it. Only you, alone, completely alone. Nobody can ever help you in this venture. Nobody can ever help you. And that's where your sacredness is. That's where your openness is. That's where there's a deep wellspring of joy and love that doesn't come from anywhere. So, a story. A short story. Because I don't want to waste your time. You know, you've got to get back to more important things, right? A short story. Very short. A few people were traveling in a small boat. Suddenly the ocean went mad, and it appeared that now the boat was going to sink at any moment. Oh, well, here's the boat. Shamatha practice, right? The boat. Everybody fell on his knees and started praying. In the boat, there was a well-known saint and also a well-known sinner. This is a, this must be a Sufi story, yeah. It's got to be a Sufi story. Not a Zen story, you know, it's a Sufi story. The sinner also fell on his knees and said, "My Lord, save us!" The saint came near to him and said, "Not so loudly." That's what saints do, right? Not so loudly. If he comes to know about you, that you are also here, then none of us is going to be saved. Then we are all going to be drowned. Not so loud. Do not remain in a dualistic state. Avoid such pursuits carefully. Carefully. Now I'm going to pick on a poor family member of mine that actually I have never picked on before, but he just arose in my consciousness when I was staying at home, resting, trying to rest while you guys are here. So this is my aunt married, in her second marriage, married a high Episcopalian priest, Father Bob. And Father Bob was very high Episcopalian, like, you know, Anglican, Catholic, like all this ritual that we do, he'd say, "Oh, that's nothing. See what I've got to show you," right? He'd say when he saw Rahatsu, "Oh, well, that's good. That's, you're getting there, but really you got to..." high church. And all the adults thought Father Bob was the cool guy. The cool guy, because he would... And we unfortunately had to go Thanksgiving at their houses. And we couldn't just eat our turkey because we had to do all this stuff first. Of course, we were just kids. And the thing is that the kids, us kids, we didn't like Father Bob. Because kids can smell stuff. Kids can smell stuff. Adults seem to lose their olfactory ability. You know what I mean? They seem to all lose it. Kids can smell stuff. They smelled Father Bob. They smelled his piety, his goody-goodiness, the way he smiled sweetly at everyone when he told them to shape up, but in a very polite way. We always avoided Father Bob. We even made mud pies and threw them at an image of Father Bob. We don't have snow in California. And my mother came out once and said, "Who is that you're throwing mud pies at?" We had built this figure. And we said, "Oh, no one, Mom, no one." So don't try to... Don't even try to be a bodhisattva very much, you guys. If you try to be a bodhisattva very much, you'll cut off your wellspring of being, and you'll just be focused on the picture, on the image. And then you'll become kind of dead. That picture, that image will dominate you, and people will think you smell, and you do. You do. And Not very many similarities between my first two teachers, but one similarity between them, Katagiri Roshi and Suzuki Roshi, is that kids like to be around them. Kids really like to be around them. And Katagiri Roshi came to visit us when we were living in northern Minnesota, and my kids were little, with his wife and his boys, and he spent 2 or 3 days, and my kids had a wonderful time, and I had a good time. And then for months after, my daughter Erin said, "Where did that policeman go? I miss that policeman. That policeman really knew how to play." And I said, "Well, he lives down in the city, Erin." "No, he's living in the city." "Well, can we go to the city and see that policeman?" Oh, little did she know. Much later, I think she probably felt entirely different because we came down here and she didn't see me that much. So, since you don't need to remain in a dualistic state, it's not a good idea, then if you're having trouble with your meditation, your concentration, your shamatha or your vipassana, don't even do it. Just sit here. Just let the mind troll on. Just let it troll on. Why not? Are you a bad meditator if you let the mind troll on? You'll never become Father Bob. You'll never become Tim. Why should you become Father Bob or Tim? Become who you are. The mind is trolling on. Maybe you should just let the mind troll on. Maybe you should follow Suzuki Roshi's advice, which is, what? If you want to tame your horse, what? What? Huh? Give it a large pasture. Do you have a large enough pasture here during Rahatsu? Are you doing enough sitting, staring at the wall of this huge, huge pasture? So sometimes take a break from trying to go anywhere, from trying to be anything. And then when you're ready, come back and use shamatha and vipassana just to soak yourself in the sea. Just to soak yourself in the sea. Even though they're just made up to. Do not remain in the dualistic state. Avoid such pursuits carefully. So Suzuki Roshi and Katagiri Roshi were also quite good about that. And of course, I remember it more with Suzuki Roshi than Katagiri Roshi because he's my root teacher. I remember it more, even though it was longer ago. And so here's a story about Suzuki Roshi, which I have told, but probably Nancy won't remember it. Because I may have told it even before she started coming. But my memory is not so good, so maybe I told it last week. But anyway, the story is, my teacher, Suzuki, and I, he didn't drive. So I drove him places. And I was one day driving him from Palo Alto to San Francisco, from my home to his home. And it was after a morning sitting, and he said, let's stop, and I need to see a woman whom I want to talk with. And he had an address of this woman, and he had directions to her house. And I, this must have been the morning, because our sitting would end in Palo Alto at like 8 or 9. And I probably had an afternoon class I had to get back to at Stanford, but I didn't. In those days, I was not interested in going to class as much, so I much preferred being with him. So I thought, oh, that's cool. But it was a really mixed-up way to get up there, and he didn't know it was in Hillsboro. And I hadn't even been to Hillsboro much. And he kept saying, turn this way, And then he had this little paper, but it wasn't written in English, so I couldn't tell. And I was beginning to get kind of annoyed because even though I didn't go to my early morning classes, I like to go later in the day to my classes. It's true. True. I mean, you know, you get guilty after. Everybody has a certain threshold, right? And my threshold was that I got to be there for my 1 o'clock class. And so there we were, wandering around the hills in Hillsboro, looking for Mrs. So-and-so. I don't know what the deal was with Mrs. So-and-so, who even she was. Finally, we got way up to the top of the hill. Hillsboro is a classy place in the San Francisco area. My parents, I grew up in Palo Alto. Now, you think Palo Alto is classy. It was not classy when I was growing up. Everybody wanted to live in Atherton or Hillsboro. And my father had aspirations. When he set the compass of his heart, it wasn't to the deathless. It was to entering the upper class. It was from moving to from upper middle class to upper class. Then we could live in Hillsboro. So I never even hardly went to Hillsboro. Except my dad was always talking about it. And then we get up to this great big house in Hillsboro. And he said, "You wait in the car. I'll go in and see Mrs. Jones." Okay. So I'm waiting. The car is going up this long path. I see him go to the house. Then I lose track of him. There's some shrubs. He's gone for maybe 10, 15 minutes. He comes back. And by that time, I'm annoyed. I mean, you know, at least he could have good directions. He knows I'm a college student. He knows my dad is paying big money for me to go to college, even though I'm not attending classes. He doesn't know I'm not attending classes. Big money to go to Stanford, you guys. Big money. How rude of me. How disrespectful of me. And now this teacher isn't respecting me. He's just gone off doing something crazy up there. And so he comes back. And he's laughing. And he opened the door and get in. He said, "Oh, okay. Okay, well, this, did you, you know, this woman must be delightful, right? Delightful student or something? Sensei, we call him sensei. Delightful student, is she a student?" He said, "Oh, no, wrong woman." He said, wrong Jones. He said, "Wrong Jones. She thought I was there to wash windows." And he laughed again. You know, he was dressed in his black traveling clothes. "She thought I was there to wash windows." He said, "But I didn't bring my squeegee, so I couldn't wash." Do not dwell in a dualistic state. If you soak yourself in the Buddha nature sea, you will stop dwelling in the Buddha nature in the dualistic state. You'll just stop. You won't know it. If you know it, you haven't stopped. But others will feel it. Other people will feel it. They'll just feel it. If there is even a trace of this and that, or right and wrong, the mind essence will be lost in confusion. Oh. Do I have time for another story? No. I do, because I've got a captive audience that has to go back and sit. So Suzuki Roshi taught me to follow my breathing in my sitting and to count my breathing when my mind started to wander. And so I did that religiously. And then when I opened a group in Palo Alto, which he asked me to open, which he came down to every week and sat and gave talks at, and we finally had a pretty large group come, like 8 people. For a long time, he just came and we only had 3 people, 8 or 9 people. And then we sat, and then he would talk. So he sat this one time, and we had this large group of 8 or 9. Seemed large. And he told everybody about their posture, you know, how to hold their posture, how to hold their mudra, how to put the hands like this, how to straighten the spine. And he gave a little talk, pretty unintelligible talk, even though, yeah, pretty unintelligible talk. And then I said, Sensei, will you tell people the right way to do zazen, the right way to do zazen? You showed them the form, now you show them the right way to do zazen. He said, oh, I can't do that. There's no right way. I thought, okay, well, here these people are here. He's taught them this posture, but he's given them no instruction. He's not going to teach them to follow their breathing or anything. I think he's not understanding me. So I said, Sensei, the correct way, because he doesn't like right and wrong, right? He's a Zen teacher, no right and wrong. The correct way to do zazen, the correct way to handle your thoughts as they come up. He said, oh, no correct way. No correct way. I am kind of annoyed by that time. I'm the one who recruited all these Stanford students to come in the first place. And they're not even going to teach them about following their breathing. If there is either a trace of this and that, or right and wrong, the mind essence will be lost in confusion. So, just continue, please, to come back to your aspiration, come back to your intention. During this retreat, during your weekend, during your life, when you get off course, when you're caught by your thinking, when you're caught by your worry, when you're not here, just come back and reset your compass, the compass of your heart, over and over again. And then something might happen. Who knows? Who knows? Something will. And so now, a bunch of you are going to be leaving. A bunch of you are going to be staying. I'm going to be staying for a little while, and then I'm going to go home and rest. I don't like it. I want to be here. But I'm here. Where can I go? Where can I go? You always want to be somewhere else in the enlightened state. Oh, yeah, okay, well, I know you do. I know you do. Sounds good, doesn't it? Sounds comforting. Open it. Whatever. And those of you who are leaving, some of you are new to Zen, some of you are old to Zen, don't leave. Where is there to go? Where is there to go? Is there any place to go? Really? Is there any place to go other than this place? This place? And on the other hand, everything is going. Everything is leaving. Everything is deserting us. Everything is changing. So when we stay, let's not stay. If we stay, determined to stay, stop the thinking, control the thinking. So if you stay, those of you who are staying, don't stay. What is there to stay for? To get something? To get calmed down? Don't stay. Go out of your mind. Go out of your mind. Only you, alone and sacred.